I was just thinking, like, what am I going to name this podcast? Watch out, Curtin's going to F you up.
No, I think if you're faking your data, they will find you. It might not be me who's finding you. I don't think I believe in the big breakthrough. And in a way, that's fine. Like, the brain is the ultimate frontier. There could be nothing bigger for mankind than understand how we think, how our brains work.
This is Brain Inspired.
Welcome. This is Paul Middlebrooks. Today, I talk with Conrad Curting, whom, as you'll hear, has been lingering in the background of the show for many episodes now. Conrad is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and he was hired into a position specifically created for someone who brings together multiple disciplines and multiple research groups from those disciplines. He's made a career out of massive collaboration, and it's worked wonders for him and for science. I will leave it up to you to explore his website to see for yourself the breadth and the depth of his work. And that'll be linked in the show notes. It's at braininspired.co/podcast/14. I think you might find this episode to be one of the more fun episodes for a few reasons. One, it's short. Conrad had a tight schedule, so you're welcome to many of you who prefer a shorter episode. Number two, Conrad likes to have fun, and that comes across readily. And three, we discuss his recent paper with Daniel Acuna about work that they did to automatically detect fraudulent images in scientific papers. So if you're shaking in your shoes right now, that is not a good sign for you, my friend. They will find you. I also get Conrad's passionate take on consciousness and more general questions. Okay, if you have a question for me or that you would like me to ask a guest, send an email to paul@braininspired.co. Send me the question either as written text or preferably as an audio file of you speaking. As always, you can connect with me on Twitter. I am at PGMid. And here is Conrad Curting. Conrad Curting, your fingerprints have been all over this podcast so far. So thanks and welcome. And it's nice to finally have you on the show.
It's great to be here.
So you are currently the Penn Integrates Knowledge Professor at University of Pennsylvania. Now, I will have introduced you more in the introduction, but can you just talk a little bit about what that means?
Yeah, so this is a program that our president put up. It's meant to hire people who will bring people and departments together. So for someone like me, this is perfect because the job description is basically to do what I do, which is bring a lot of different people and departments together into joint ideas.
Oh, I'm going to ask you about that in just a second. So, but just to enumerate how binding you are within the episodes of my show. So in episode 8, you had done the work with Josh Glazer about how to use machine learning tools and neuroscience and which decoders work best to predict movement velocities, et cetera. In episode 9 with Blake Richards, he mentioned your name. You do have the most mentioned name in the show. So we talked about how back propagation might work in the brain. And again, you have a 2001 paper suggesting almost the same thing that Blake Richards has been working on. And in episode 10, you co-authored a paper with Adam Marblestone. And you've worked with him in multiple papers, but we talked about toward an integration of deep learning and neuroscience. So it wasn't intentional to have that little run where you're all over it, but here we are. So
yeah, I feel bad about that. What can I say?
Oh yeah, you're too famous. So my first question is kind of a big one here. So is it a skateboard or a longboard that you ride to work?
Well, it is a long skateboard. I'd call it a longboard. Long skateboards are called longboards.
Okay, yeah, that's true.
And the reason why I need that is the streets are really bad in Philadelphia, and I commute to work with the skateboard almost every day. So I need a good long skateboard.
Oh, I see. I thought maybe you just didn't like being honked at on a bicycle or something.
No, I really like the feeling. You see, I love snowboarding as well and surfing, and longboards feel very similar.
Oh, we just got our first good snow here in Durango, Colorado, so I'm looking forward to the snowboarding too.
Okay, that's not fair, because there's no snow showing up here anytime soon.
You know, I lived in Tennessee, so I don't feel very, very feel free. So, Conrad, one of your signatures, as you mentioned, one of the things that you're known for is that you collaborate with so many people in so many different labs. Can you just, before we get into talking about what we're going to talk about today, can you talk about the importance of collaborating and how it's helped your work?
Yeah, I think the world is changing. It used to be that a single person could do most big things in the world. But I think, you see, we start producing really big data sets. It starts to be that the experiments that people run are like really, really complicated. It starts to be that the conceptual work of just like, what does it mean that we're getting? It's really baffling us. So in a way, the whole world is drifting towards a collaborative mode of working. And I think the reason why you see my lab in a lot of projects in neuroscience is just we totally embrace that idea. The world is basically, if you want to solve big problems, you have to work with a lot of good people and you have to specialize. And it's a difficulty for a lot of people. Now, like the original model in neuroscience is you're a big established guy and you hire everyone. Everything is around that one person, the leader who runs it. And I think we see the end of that. We're basically, in the past, that person would almost always be an experimentalist and they might hire someone who analyzes the data. But in reality, if you have a lab that is run by an experimentalist, they can't really supervise a computational person. So I think everything is getting better in a way by moving towards a collaborative way of operating.
Yeah, I know. Even when I went into graduate school, one of the things that was touted in a lot of the places that I applied was how collaborative all their labs are. And I think some people are more naturally suited for that kind of work. For example, Carl Olson, who's a computational neuroscience researcher at University of Pittsburgh, he told a story about how he really begrudgingly started collaborating with people because he was so used to working by himself and enjoyed it so much, but how it was the best thing to do in the long run. So I think that you're really onto something there.
Yeah, it's also more fun. Besides, I really love coffee and all the collaborations give me an excuse to drink copious amounts of coffee.
Good. I'm having mine right now as well. So, Conrad, I've been doing everything in my power to prevent you from being on the podcast, like I said. But but one day I was sitting in my little podcast studio here, minding my own business, avoiding my family, of course, thinking, who can I pester next about neuroscience and AI? And all of a sudden, the brain chip in my head alerts me to a new email from one Conrad Curding. And all the email says is, we need to talk. And there's this paper attached to the email. The paper was called Bioscience Scale Automated Detection of Figure Element Reuse. Conrad, just give it to me straight. What is it you found in my prolific, illustrious, unparalleled record of high-impact, jaw-dropping, potential mating partner swooming body of research publication? What did you find, sir?
So look, I don't like people who fake their papers. Yeah. And it dawned upon us that we could capture those guys. And that's how that project started. And I just thought that, like, if I'm to be on a podcast, that would be the most fun thing we could possibly talk about.
It is fun. I was just thinking, like, what am I going to name this podcast? You know, watch out, Curding's going to F you up.
No, I think if you're faking your data, they will find you. It might not be me who's finding you, but whoever's out there currently faking your data, you will be in a world of hurt.
So this paper is all about figure reuse. Let's just, but for people who don't even know, because this was actually new to me because I'm so innocent. So what is the inappropriate reuse of figure elements, and what are some examples of why someone might do it?
Okay, so let's say you're a biologist, and the reviewers make you do a control where they say, well, we think this paper might be all wrong because your antibodies might not be working or something. They make you do an extra experiment. And now there are people who aren't entirely honest under those circumstances. And if a biologist fakes data, a good proportion of cases, they will not really fake data, but they're going to use a photo they already have on their computer and pretend it shows something else. Oh. So let's say you have a photo of cells growing nicely and you have a photo of cells dying. And you have a video, you have a paper that you publish, which shows, if I do this thing, I prevent the cells from dying. That's great. But then people might say, well, maybe it was the time of the day that prevented the cells from dying. Can you redo the experiment? And now maybe you haven't done that experiment. Maybe you don't want to do it, but you have another photo on your hard disk that also shows cells not dying, that nice, happily live. You might just use that other photograph to not have to do that extra work, no? And so in general, like, lots of biologists that are faking their data have been caught by them basically doing what's image fraud, where you see the same image in two papers. In one case, it shows one thing. In the other paper, it shows another thing.
So you were just talking about within the same paper, because a reviewer might ask you to do a new experiment. But now you're talking about a cross paper. So just to give an overview of what you guys did here, you looked at over 2 million figures over tons and tons of papers. And just to keep it from combinatorially exploding, you restricted the analysis to papers that shared an author, right? Within one paper or across papers that shared an author. Is that right? That's right. Okay.
Yeah, let me highlight what the procedure would be.
Yep.
So imagine I suspect you, Paul, to be a malicious fraudster.
Damn you, Conrad. Okay.
Sorry about that. Imagine I would. I would never do such a thing, but imagine I would. Then what I would do is I would download all your papers, and then I would take all the figures out of all your papers. And then I'd want to check, do I see the same figure appear multiple times? And I might find, like, oh, in that one paper you say that's the control condition, and in another paper you say that's the treated condition. And then I could say, oh, this is like really fraud. Like, it can't be both at the same time. Mm-hmm. Now, how does an algorithm do that? The problem is, if people do that, they aren't stupid. Not like what people might do. They might flip the image upside down with the hope that a human can't see it anymore. And in fact, it's hard to see it. In fact, they might like rotate the image a little bit and recrop it and change the contrast and do all these changes to make it hard to spot them. They just do image fraud.
There are humans that do this at journals. Is that right?
That's right. A lot of people have been found out to be frauds by someone just doing it by eye. You know, like, in the past, what I would have done is I would have like printed out all your paper, put them all on my desk, and looked, do I see anything that looks suspicious? And instead of doing that by hand, we can now do it algorithmically.
Okay, but so this is a case where it's AI assisted work, because it's not fully automated. So you had an original algorithm that originally went through all the figures, and then, well, maybe you can just tell me the process.
Right. So it's a three-stage process. The first thing is, for fraudulent image reuse, well, you need to reuse an image. So for that, we have an algorithm that can basically mine through all the paper and find every image region that has been reused, and that even it doesn't mind if you rotate it or change contrast, change color, it will still find all those. So that's the first stage. We find basically that images are reused. The problem is, you will find lots of really boring things. You will find, let's say, lots of x-axis that all have time on it. And in fact, like, my own work might have all kinds of x-axis that have time, open bracket, seconds, close bracket to it.
Right.
So that is reuse of an image region. It's just like really boring reuse. So we have the outputs of the first stage, which finds reused image regions, then goes through a second stage, which looks for interesting reuse. And the interesting we used, and basically it means that it's something that doesn't look like it's random. It doesn't look like it's just like an axis of something. The way that works is we give the computer a big database where we said, well, this is boring we use. And it learns how the boring things look like. It basically learns that axis and standard brain images and a whole bunch of things that the fields use don't mean anything by themselves. So, for example, you might find a map of America in all kinds of papers where maybe something is highlighted. That doesn't mean that they're all fraudulent papers. It just means that they're all looking at the same map of America.
Right.
So we don't want those things. And that's why we have that second stage. And then by that time, we will have gotten rid of most of the bad things, of the uninteresting things. So we can have the humans focus on the cases where there's quite possibly something wrong. And of that last stage, the third stage, as we call it, a good proportion of the images we have, of the papers we have prompts.
Yeah, do you want to just spit out some numbers of what percentage that you found? And you didn't, you know, name any researchers or papers or anything like that. So this is just a sort of a proof of principle, right?
Yeah, so we haven't solved our ethical problems yet. Mm. So let's first name some numbers. If I remember that right, and I've done hundreds of them, about every 10 images about 10 papers that I see that have reused, that basically passed the first two stages, there's really something wrong with it. So now that produces an ethical problem, which is some of the image misuse will be stupidity. Let's say I'm a microscopist. I have 10,000 images on my hard disk, and I accidentally use the wrong image. That doesn't make me a fraudster. That just makes me careless. There are probably a lot more careless people in the world than there are fraudsters in the world.
One would hope.
I am pretty positive about that.
Yeah.
So certainly I could see myself sometimes being careless because, well, there's like all kinds of things in life. Now, like, so if we would, we basically now sit on a big database of very likely of papers where we can be sure that something is wrong. We know that these two images cannot at the same time show what the two papers say. But we can't be sure, is that stupidity or is this fraud? And that leads to a big ethical problem for us that we haven't yet solved. What should we do with it?
Right.
No, we could put it all on some web page, but people would bring out the pitchforks.
Yes.
And it wouldn't be nice in that sense. So at the same time, letting the fraudsters, undoubtedly there's a good number of fraudsters in the list that we have, letting the fraudsters run free is also not the right thing. So we are trying to work towards a solution where we can make this be a standard part of doing science. We say every new paper in the world, according to us, should be scanned for if there are signs of image mistakes.
I wonder if there should be a system like you've tried to log in 3 times, so we're resetting your password, that sort of thing, you know, 3 red flags and then, or something like that, you know?
Maybe.
I don't know. I haven't thought about it, but you know, it seems harder to me so coding, there's a lot of room for stupidity and carelessness, but making images, it seems more difficult to make errors via stupidity using images.
I don't know. See, in lots of biology papers, there might be 30 microscopy images.
Right.
No,
right.
It might be like, this is the 10 micromolar calcium paper, this is the 30 micromolar calcium condition, and so forth. For all of them, you have a microscopy image. Can it happen that you mislabel them on your computer? Yes, I think there's honest mistakes that people could make.
Yeah, that's true. So you're not, you don't release the code. You can't find the code or the algorithm on GitHub. Why is that?
We should make it. It's for exactly that same reason. Given what we have, it would be very, very easy for someone to just rerun our code and get that list of a large number of probably fraudulent papers. So we feel that we need to solve it before we make that code openly available.
Yeah, that's a good project. Can I just make one guess? And you don't have to answer, but are convolutional neural networks involved?
They're not.
Oh, man, I missed. Okay.
Good. That's okay. Let's highlight why.
Okay.
The problem that we have here isn't so much a problem that we want to recognize something. The problem that we have here is that we are basically drowning in data. Keep in mind that we have 2 million images.
Yeah.
Now, each image can arguably, you want to be able to detect the reuse of small regions. So each image might legitimately contain 100 different sub-regions or something.
Right.
So all of a sudden, you're in this like crazy large space where you want to check if there's reuse. So once you give me that there's a hint of a reuse, it gets to be a relatively easy problem. The problem is how can we compare very large numbers of papers without running out of runtime? Not like a million papers, that is 10 to the 12 pairs of images.
Yeah.
So whereas there's this old framework that is more like, it's called SIFT features. It takes an image, finds interesting points, and describes a neighborhood of those. And that is a much better match for what we want to do in this domain.
Hmm.
And so our algorithm is relatively similar to that.
Well, so like you said, there are the three stages. And then the third stage is reviewing by eye. And there are three authors on the paper, and all three of you reviewed a lot. Well, I see that you didn't review the most by eye, but one author stood out as the clear laggard. Was that author just lazy?
I think that author was lazy, and that author might have been me.
No, you were second. You were second place. It was a pretty large discrepancy. But it was over, if I remember correctly, almost 3,000 images that you guys looked at.
But I'm pretty sure I was the laggard. I'm sorry.
I caught you. Really, see, I wanted to catch you with something.
I'm really positive about it. Yes, I'm the lazy guy.
Oh, just busy. Let's say busy. So,
sounds much better. Yeah.
How many man hours did it take you to? So that's something you didn't report. Is just how long it took you each to go through your sets of figures. Like, how fast is it to go through one and look at it and be able to tell?
I'm sure we have statistics for that. So. So let me highlight how the process looks like. So basically, you're on this web page, you see 10 papers at a time. Each of those papers, you basically, in fact, 10 pairs of papers. So you basically see two figures, you see some red markings that say, here's this suspiciously similar region. And then you basically have links with which you can get to the papers. Now, I would say maybe two thirds of papers, you look at it and you're like immediately clear that this is not inappropriate.
Mm-hmm.
No, so that includes maybe there's like a sketch of methods that people use in two figures, in two papers. That's not fraud, that might be like inappropriately not cited, but like that's not something that makes me worried.
Right.
So I will not spend time on these examples where it's and you see that within seconds. So for two thirds of them, you can be like really quite sure. And then you find the ones and for the remaining third, then you've got to click on the papers. Now, it basically takes, let's say, 10 seconds for the two papers to open. Now, in maybe half of them, and like I might be somewhat off at the ratios, but like roughly, in maybe half of them, you go there and it will say in one of the two, in the later of the two papers, it will say replotted from X. And then it's clear, okay, that's good, that's fine. Then there are the obvious fraud cases. Or like, no, there's something wrong cases where you also don't need to even click on anything. You might see that in the same figure, you have you have what seems like a mistake. Now, like it might be a titration, and like number three might be the same as number seven, but otherwise the main effect is there, and you might not want to call it a fraud. That's like a clear image mistake. But then there are the cases where it seems that it just fits the narrative of the paper beautifully without making sense that it's that paper. In some cases, it's also like it obviously can't be. This is one figure and it shows a completely different cell line or something like that. And then there are like the real hardcore fraudsters, which is also fun. There are some people who take the same image and rotate it by 30 degrees and recrop it a little bit. And it's like, well, you guys have been creative at this.
Yes.
And no, and you find the same figure like flip and like it's a little more orange than the previous one, and then you really get the impression that here's the real master at fraud.
Did you ever find one with a sort of a middle finger translucently embedded in there?
That would be hilarious. I wonder what's going on psychologically. No, like, what would you be thinking if you'd be doing such a thing?
It's crazy. It's a crazy thing to do.
Well, but like, yeah, I mean, like maybe people are worried about their life as a scientist, maybe about tenure, maybe the system puts too much pressure onto people.
I guess, but you're throwing up your whole career for and be ousted anyway. So I don't know.
Yeah, but the people who do that don't think they can get caught. That's why it happens so often. They believe that's safe. They don't know that. That's why we made sure that when despite the fact that we didn't yet solve our ethical problem, that we put it out as a preprint as early as possible, that we also talked Nature into like doing a little article about it, because we want people to know that like they can't do that.
Two things. One, I'm wondering if other journals are showing interest in the work, and two, so by putting the paper out, there must be a name for this phenomenon, but you might be lowering the future rate of fraudulent reuse of images just by showing that this resource could be used. What do you think?
That is the idea. That's why we made sure to at least get the word about the existence of this approach out fast. We hope that it will help fix things. Hmm. I'm reasonably hopeful about that. I mean, the thing is that forensic data analysis is really coming very quickly at us. Now, say you're now expected to publish the data of everything you're doing for most modern journals. You will be expected to upload all your microscopy images. Once people are forced to put in good images, it will be so easy to detect any kind of fraud. Now, if you Photoshop an image, there is a signature of Photoshopping that's still in there. And if people, band splicing was a big thing. When they do these Western blots, that they just take a line of one Western blot, put it into another and things like that. That thing is also getting fully observable. So I think anyone who still fakes data is in for a rude awakening.
Well, it's good work here, Conrad. Thanks for talking with me about it. So, I know that you're pretty short on time, and I'm going to plan on having you back on the show, if you'll come back on at a later time, to talk about causality. What is something that you're working on now that you're excited about in the lab?
So causality is at the moment what I'm most excited about.
It is, okay.
Because look, in neuroscience, we want to find out how things work. And in a way, how things work is a causal question. But yeah, I'm very broadly interested in things. I'm interested in what it would mean to understand the brain. I'm interested in how an understanding of the brain should look like.
Yeah.
I'm interested in what we can learn from deep learning. And that's you covered that area extensively. I think it's the most promising way of thinking about the brain that we have at the moment.
Oh, see, okay. Well, I was going to ask if you think that deep learning is overblown or underblown, or if it's just right blown.
So I think it's a very natural progression. And let me give you a very high reason for the existence and usefulness of deep learning. So a long time ago, when we did computer science, we as humans coded the solution to the problem. That's what we call good old-fashioned AI. Mm-hmm. We basically built the solutions to it. And then we figured that that wasn't tenable, and we switched to optimization. So for a long while then, computer science was, we take a problem, we write it as an optimization problem, we as humans give it the function, and the computer finds what the parameters are that are most useful for that. No, and that includes how we fly fighter pilots, all the way to how we solve all kinds of estimation problems.
Right.
I've done a lot of Bayesian statistics over time, and that's all based on that idea that we build in how we believe the world works. A human writes down the function with maybe parameters that characterize how uncertain we are. We don't know what the influence of that on that is, but we know what its parametric form is. So humans put in the model, and the computers put in the parameters. Now, deep learning is in a way the obvious next step for that, which is, so why is it better to learn the parameters than having humans set it? Because, well, the humans just don't know what the right parameters are. But if we have humans put in the functional form of it, well, humans don't know the functional form. So you can say what deep learning is. It basically says, instead of me specifying this is how the output depends on the input, I say, all I know is that the output will smoothly depend on the input, or sparsely, or hierarchical. So instead of putting in the full knowledge of what I know about the world, which I usually don't, because, well, we don't understand the world where we're in, we instead build in very soft things where we say, things are smooth, and like the world is translation invariant, and we build in knowledge of that kind. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, deep learning is the natural progression of computer science, where we went from we built the solution to we built the function and the computer finds the parameters, to now the computer finds the parameters and also the function.
But it seems like there's a trend recently of building back in some assumptions into the deep learning models, like, for instance, building dendritic compartments within the units and making one unit not one unit, but it's a unit with multiple subunits, or things like that, and I'm wondering how far that's going to go.
So there's two sides. Let me separate it into two questions. The first one is how the brain does it, or does the brain do it like that? The other one is as a technical system. So as a technical system, there's like no doubt that it helps, but yes, it also helps to build in at least cognitive things. You know? Today's deep learning systems often do have attention. They do have routing circuits. They have memory. They start having a lot of the things that we as cognitive scientists discovered for people. But then the other question is how the brain operates also somewhat like deep learning? And that's an area that, from my perspective, is a hugely promising approach to neuroscience, because if we are honest, we don't have meaningful models for the brain at the moment.
Right.
And deep learning is in a way promising there, because deep learning in lots of ways looks like brain, shares a lot of properties with the brain, and you can make an evolutionary argument that it should be a bit like the brain.
I mean, it's really refreshing and to hear someone talk about how little we know about the brain and how few models and theories there are. So, I mean, do you think that the big breakthrough, and people talk about how there hasn't been an Einstein-type breakthrough, right, for understanding our brains and minds, do you think that that's going to come from AI or neuroscience or that this collaboration or somewhere else? You have a physics background. Maybe it's coming from physics, you know?
I don't think I believe in the big breakthrough. And in a way, that's fine. Like, the brain is the ultimate frontier. There could be nothing bigger for mankind than understand how we think, how our brains work. So I don't think that we should be waiting for, like, a big breakthrough. we will be making progress in lots of areas. And among others, I think what we need to do is figure out what it means for us to make progress about understanding
yeah.
the mind.
Yeah.
And I think the problem is at the moment, we are probably trying to reach something that is fundamentally logically not reachable.
You know, I have lots of people ask me questions about what we know about the brain, and it's often frustrating because I want to say almost nothing, and that's frustrating to them, you know. So I could talk about numbers and what we found, but to ask what we really know about the brain, 60 minutes is wrong. We don't know anything about the brain, you know.
So Betsy, like, we know lots of correlational things,
sure.
no?
Yep.
We know that there's a lot of cells in the back of my head that correlate with the contrast in the visual scene. We know a lot of those things. We know a lot of things about anatomy. But how the neurons get correlated to that, we don't know that very much. Now, like, the problem is what our question is in neuroscience. The question that we all ask, if you probe us on this, is a causal question. We want a mechanism. We want, like, how does the light go to the eye? Makes activity there, make activity there, make activity there, makes me talk in a funny way with you. And that chain of causal influences, we don't have tools in neuroscience to really ask that, how that chain works.
Well, I'm glad that you're working on causality. That's wonderful. Okay. Conrad, so you're at a pretend like you're at a cocktail party and you've had a couple cocktails here. So best guess.
I get drunk extremely easily.
Okay, well we'll go ahead. Three, too many. Let's say you've had too many.
Nice. Easy.
These won't be hard. So, but I want you to give me a number here. When do you think we'll know what we're talking about when we say consciousness?
Never.
Okay. Okay, that's good. So Blake Richards mentioned that it'll just kind of be explained away over time, and we won't think of it as a thing. It'll be explained away as functions.
But look, this is bullshit. Like, consciousness relates to a way how we feel about ourselves and about the world. Mm-hmm. What gives neuroscience the right to say anything in that space? Now, like, there are many levels of description. Why is reductionism the right way of answering that? Mm-hmm. No, like, you can say things like maybe anger or consciousness, they don't necessarily, the link to the substrate might be very hard, and it might in fact be like basically so complex that it's useless. Whereas saying, well, consciousness, it's not the argument, the evolutionary argument for consciousness or anger is like very easy. It's you can make a very clean argument why having something like a record of the things you've done in the past or what your objectives and goals are, why that is useful from an evolutionary perspective. Mm. Once you go into that hardcore reductionist thing, that it's like, sure, like, the brain's made out of physics, so you can say neuroscience isn't necessary. It's all just like physics all the way down. But no, that's not the right words for that. So the idea that it will just be explained away, that doesn't even make sense.
So, man, I'm going to have Blake and you on, and this will be fun. I didn't know you're an angry drunk. This is awesome.
By the way, Blake is super awesome.
I know.
Hey, I forgot something when we talked earlier,
uh-huh.
which is, I didn't mention that paper about detecting fraud in science was beautiful work by my former postdoc, Daniel Acuna, who is now professor at Syracuse, and I'm super proud of him. And I just wanted to say that he's great, and it's important to mention the good things he's done here. It was a very complicated project just because of the scale of things.
Yeah, I bet. Okay, so we just have just a couple more minutes. I have just a couple more questions, okay?
Go for it.
All right, so what is something, take a sip, what is something that you believe about neuroscience and or artificial intelligence that might be a little out there, that might be a little unconventional?
Well, I believe that the answers we are seeking are all answers for which there may not exist answers. I think we are looking for, we're trying to answer the wrong questions in yours.
Yes, thank you. Okay. So I love that answer. So even before I was in graduate school, I was a tech in a research neuroscience research lab, and I was auditing this class, and it happened my advisor was teaching it. And I don't remember what the question is, but I raised my hand and I said, you know, maybe we're not asking the right questions. And he said, well, what are the right questions? And I said, I don't know. just a tech.
Yeah. No, I think this is the right way of thinking about it.
Okay, Conrad, what is your advice for people who want to accomplish as much as you, aside from collaboration?
I think having fun. I think playing is really the basis of good scientific inquiry. I think we have probably learned an awful lot about the world by just trying to blow things up and making things fail. And playing with things and playing with ideas is entirely underrated.
Very good. Last question. What is something that you wish was on your CV that's not?
I wish there was an explicit mention of dinosaurs in my CV. So subject zero is the mascot of the lab, and I just love dinosaurs, and everyone in the lab loves dinosaurs. And yet, if you look at my CV, there's not one mention of dinosaurs. So I would like to find an excuse to have a chapter on dinosaurs on my CV, or at least a paper that has dinosaur in the title.
Okay, people, you heard Conrad. He loves dinosaurs. He loves to collaborate. So get on it. Contact me. Contact him. You're at Cording Lab on Twitter?
That's right. Exactly.
And people should probably go there, and I'll link to your lab site. Is that another place you recommend people learn more about you and what you do?
Yeah, that sounds great.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you, Conrad. I appreciate your time. I know you have to go. I'm going to, if I don't get caught for fraud, then I will have you back on the show, and we'll talk about causality.
That would be great fun. I had great fun talking with you.
Okay, thank you.
Great, see you.
See, I told you that would be fun. If you like the show, please leave a review on iTunes and or tell your grandma and her friends about it. See you next time.